And I actually think the version of health insurance that works best is when it's actually completely out of the way and invisible. I have this fundamental belief that when done correctly, healthcare is between a patient and the doctor, and the insurance is almost out of the picture.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winodo.
During Cedric Kovac's pursuit of an undergraduate degree in chemical engineering, his initial focus did not involve healthcare or business. But the disparities in access and affordability in healthcare drove him to realize how healthcare is another marketplace waiting to be coordinated. Committed to improving the efficiency in communication and coordination among healthcare vendors to lower overall costs, Cedric dedicated a year to immerse himself in learning, listening, and engaging with telehealth experts to identify the key problem. In this episode, Cedric discusses his journey in founding Flume, a digital health plan administrator designed to seamlessly connect insurance entities with the nuanced interactions between doctors and patients. Here's our conversation. Well, welcome, Cedric. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
And it's so exciting to hear from fellow badgers. It's not that many of us here in California.
That's right.
You're much younger than me.
It's all relative.
Yeah. So I just thought I always like to start with the beginning of your journey. Like, what inspired you to be in healthcare? And I found it's really interesting that you study chemical engineering out of all places, and being in healthcare, that's usually not the connection that I make. But give me a lowdown.
Just to start from the beginning, I think I've always been a tinkerer growing up. I always loved building things, competing in science fairs, or just building inventions just for myself. And I wasn't really sure what I wanted to be when I grew up. I actually heard chemical engineering was the hardest major at Wisconsin, and that's partly why I chose it. It was sort of like a challenge, less that I wanted to be a chemical engineer more than anything. But when I think about healthcare, where I am now, I really have no business being in healthcare. In fact, like, healthcare was an area I explicitly did not want to go in early. I never wanted to be a doctor or anything of that nature. But I loved thinking in systems, and that's really what I think chemical engineering teaches you how to do, is think how the different systems operate and how you go through a system to get to a desired output. My first startup had nothing to do with healthcare. It was a 3D printing company. I started with some friends, actually senior year of college. And by the time we graduated, we had 3 patents, and we'd invented a way to do full color 3D printing. And we were very fortunate. We were able to sell the company when I was about 22 years old. So I was in 3D printing, saw some momentum, but really started thinking about what are major kind of global issues that I want to work on next and commit maybe the next 10 years of my career too, and think hard about. And I was thinking a lot about financial services and access. I was also thinking about healthcare. And part of the reason I really kind of narrowed in on healthcare in particular, there was a major family crisis sort of happening in my world, where my little sister, who was struggling with epilepsy her entire life, was going through the motions of getting ready for a major brain surgery. This was now about 3.5 years ago. But what led up to that brain surgery was basically arm wrestling with her insurance company. We were sometimes waiting months and months just to get the diagnostics approved, right? And so what occurred to me going through that process, as I was already curious about healthcare, was this takeaway that if you're a patient in the United States, it's not really your doctor that's calling the shots. It's really your health insurance that's calling the shots. And so I started asking questions of how do health insurance companies run? Who's actually making the decisions behind the scenes? And I think it was just honestly a sense of curiosity and like hunger to solve like a meaningful problem, but also like, how does this actually work, that led me to where I am now. And one of the things I learned is that health insurance, the company, the name on the ID card that you have, is actually a supply chain of vendors and different parties that all play small roles, but they're all kind of incongruous with each other. And so what was really interesting was looking at healthcare as an outsider, and specifically health insurance, which I feel is the most powerful component of healthcare, really the enabler, with a sort of a systems view, and saying, how do all these pieces interoperate? And what's the sort of central hub that connects everything and makes it all possible? And what I found is that's kind of the white space where Flume is. So it's a bit of a long journey, but I'm very happy that to have come into such a complex area as a relative outsider and to have built a team around me that comes from the space and really knows the ins and outs of what they do as well.
That's great. So what did you learn through that process? And what is that white space that you found that this is the right space for you to get in?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So it was not one single insight, right? So you have to marry insight with sort of business model opportunity. And that was also a journey of itself. So I was very fortunate leaving the 3D printing world. I said, I'm going to spend a year and not try to build any one business. I'm going to spend a year in the healthcare desert, as I called it. I'm just going to wander. I'm going to talk to whoever's going to answer my cold email and just start to learn through both reading and experience and shadowing people in some cases, and always kind of focused on the insurance side. There were three or four things that I learned in that year that blew me away. The first that kind of took me by surprise was just, and now this is kind of common knowledge, was the pricing discrepancy for the same services. The notion that you could get an MRI at an outpatient imaging center, you could also get it at a hospital, and the price could be a 10x variance. That blew me away. Then the next thing that captivated me was this notion that you could pay for certain services with cash up front and spend about half of what you would even paying through your insurance. And you kind of put all these things together. I saw what was a very like eager system to move forward, but sort of unable to take the next steps. And part of what we think is holding the industry back is frankly a lack of systems and coordination on a basic infrastructure level to go to the next phase. The other thing I saw was an eagerness to start to build kind of a personalization at the health insurance level that I hope we'll touch on this a little bit more, but I think the notion that we can get to personalized health insurance writ large is a really, really promising conclusion if we play out the next few years as an industry correctly.
Can you go over more about when you say the eagerness, but the lack of infrastructure?
Yeah. So we spend our days talking to health plan executives. Some of those are health plan executives of startups and early stage health plans. Some of them are, the national payers, right? And when we present our vision for the future, we're not necessarily telling these folks something that they don't already know, that they haven't already thought of. So in many regards, we're basically presenting a solution of how you get there. So what we found is, people tend to paint these largest payers in a certain light, many of whom have not had a great experience as a patient or as a member of these health plans. And they say, okay, this is the enemy. And they say the same thing on the hospital side. And I think the reality is you have a lot of folks who are very well-intentioned, but they're working in a system where on one hand, they have to respond to regulation. On the other hand, they have years and years of legacy infrastructure around them. And then they also have kind of a very interesting like planning cycle that they have to adopt to. So when we present an idea around the future of health plans maybe being personalized or for specific benefits for specific individuals, whether that's their health conditions or their ethnicity or where they work or where they live, these are inspiring ideas and people get excited about them. And generally when we bring that up, they say, okay, but here are all the other ideas that we want to build on top of that. And they already have them kind of ready to go. So when you see that kind of excitement and that much potential energy, we simply see ourselves as an enabler.
Mm-hmm. And how do the Flume fit in? How does Flume Health fit in?
Mm-hmm. So Flume is an infrastructure business. As a member, you will almost never interact, or as a patient, you will almost never interact with Flume directly. You will be interacting with your health plan, you'll be interacting with your doctor, And Flume will be playing some role in enabling some of those interactions, some of those sort of magical moments. And I actually think the version of health insurance that works best is when it's actually completely out of the way and invisible. You know, I have this fundamental belief that when done correctly, healthcare is between a patient and the doctor, and the insurance is almost out of the picture. The way we see it right now is each party has a relationship with the health plan, and that's the first point of contact, and then you can interact with the other side. And that's actually where the name Flume comes from. A flume is a conduit of water that connects two larger bodies. So think like two lakes, there's a flume that connects. Right now we see that insurance is in the middle. We'd like to create a freer flowing between the two kind of most important pieces here.
Mm-hmm. So when you said you kind of in the background, you're providing the infrastructure, what infrastructure that is?
Yeah, so there's, we've outlined basically 43 different jobs that as a payer, you need to do well in order to run your health plan day to day. Some of these are somewhat mundane, like we need to make sure ID cards get to people's homes on time. We need to make sure we make payments on time and we process claims accurately. All these have their own challenges, but they're relatively solvable. There are a few of these 43 jobs that are really, really hard to solve. And I would say they're relatively new problems and folks haven't really invested in building solutions yet. And if we do build solutions, I think as an industry, we take a massive leap forward. So a great example of this is our product Flume Relay. So we announced Relay earlier this year, and Relay really solves the integration problem that health plans have. So if you're a health plan in 2023, on average, each employer that is using you for coverage for commercial health plan, for commercial health insurance, each employer will have 14 different point solutions built in. This is everything from your telemedicine, your pharmacy benefit manager, your disease management, your mental health providers, et cetera, go down the list. And each employer will have a different set of 14. As a health plan, this is your new network of doctors. It's sort of an unbundling of what we thought of as the health plan, the healthcare network, the provider network. And you now have to create connectivity to each of these point solutions. And it's very taxing. It's hard to maintain. It's very expensive to do up front. And in most cases, it takes 6 to 9 months to do properly. We built Relay as sort of, think of us like the app store for connectivity. So when payers install Flume Relay onto their core systems, they now have basically click button access to hundreds and soon to be thousands of vendors that they can pull in and add to their health plans.
And so this is something that they have to do for the employer, the commercial customer that they have?
Yeah, the way this works today is if you're a health plan and you want to win an incremental employer to come and join your plan, often they'll ask for a certain set of vendors or point solutions to be part of that plan. And that list 10 years ago was maybe one or two vendors to be added. That list is ballooned to 14. A lot of that 14 are in many ways like new emerging companies. So some of them are venture backed. You know, you can think of your fertility benefit all the way to your telemedicine benefit, right? And everything in between. Interestingly, many providers, many of the best providers that are creating direct contracts with employers, they now fall into this bucket of, we don't really send claims through a clearinghouse anymore. We need to build a direct transactional relationship with a plan. That is very complicated for health plans to do. It's very taxing. And so if you work with Relay and you install Relay as a payer, you can have basically click button access to all of those vendors, all those point solutions, and it folds in really easily.
And this way, they don't have to build their own system, but leveraging your expertise that is also shared with other health plan out there.
That's right. And in many cases, a lot of the most of the point solutions that exist on Relay are pre-built. So there's no going out and reinventing anything. They're literally, it's like grabbing Teladoc off the shelf and saying, I'm going to bring it and install Teladoc on my groups and that can take all of 2 minutes.
And who decide what vendors or what point solution to come?
I think that's actually a great question. I think it's one that's up for debate, sort of how prescriptive can the health plan be in 2023? I think if we wind the clock back, health plans used to be incredibly prescriptive. It was, you're buying, you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield of name a state. This is the network. This is what's covered. This is what's not. And as you've seen employers face the rising cost of care, and increasingly employers go self-funded, they're taking more kind of ownership over their benefit. And they're trying to fill some of these gaps and saying, you know what, your network isn't doing a great job at, I don't know, musculoskeletal. We want to bring Hinge in because we're getting hit hard with these costs. They mount that one at a time. So I think most health plans would like to be back in that prescriptive seat. I think the way things are going right now, and the combination of employers working with increasingly savvier brokers and advisors, means they're coming to the table with a batch of vendors that, you know, work for them. And in addition to that, I think health plans first need to figure out how to respond to that need and do so profitably and reliably and quickly. We've heard of health plans that have lost major accounts because they failed to do integrations on time. I think if they do that and they demonstrate an ability to be thoughtful about why does point solution X work better than point solution Y, they will earn the right to be prescriptive again. But right now, as far as what I can see, the employer is really driving that composition more than ever. And I think they're taking control of their benefits in a way that they hadn't in the past.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
Do you think eventually, I mean, there's a lot of the self-funded, I mean, the health plan are the one who administer the whole self-funding. And before Flume exists, then maybe they have to rely a lot on the health plan to administer their self-funding program. Do you think with times, since they are prescriptive about what they bring in, do you think then eventually they would ask somebody like Flume to take care of that part? Because then there's only one less person to deal with.
Are you referring to the employer specifically?
Yeah.
It's an interesting point. We've actually started having conversations with a few employers. Now, these are sort of large Fortune 100 type employers at this point. The solution is really built, the source of truth for what you need to transact and integrate generally lies at the health plan level. However, I think you're bringing up a really important point, which is I think many employers are eager to say, this is my health plan data. I need to be somewhat portable, and I want some agency over where, you know, what services do or do not have access to my own data. If I want to be able to shop and move around and not have lock-in with a single carrier, I want the ability to do that as well. And I'd like to understand not only which vendors am I integrating with, but also over time start to get feedback on how they're performing. Because I think a lot of employers are flying blind and saying, I don't really know if, you know, point solution A or B in like the diabetes category, which one is performing when and how. And so I think there is an eagerness from employers. I think right now the real problem is let's just solve the level one problem, which is let's get these integrated such that members can enroll and these vendors can get paid. And let's do so at a closer and closer to zero marginal cost. If we can solve that problem, then I think we get to move on to the second problem, which is vendor quality, and saying, in which context does vendor X or vendor Y succeed? An example of that might be saying, is Omada good or is Livongo good? They're both competing in the diabetes category. And the answer might be, it depends. The answer might be, you know, in rural areas, one has outperformed the other for the following reasons. And so you should actually maybe think of this in a more nuanced light than good or bad. And right now, employers don't have any of that data. And then kind of the next, the final chapter, if we get through those first two iterations, is I think we're in a position to solve member data platform, which means I'd like to be able to track any member's interactions through their network, through point solutions, through PBMs, such that you can better inform providers. I mean, what an amazing role a health plan can play if they're telling your primary care doctor information about other scripts, other authorizations, other things happening in your healthcare world that would make them better at administering care. And I think that's easily years away, but that's my hope for where Relay goes. We're solving this very narrow integration problem, but I think if we do that well and we continue to scale that up, we get the right to solve the second and third and fourth order problems beyond it as well.
And that's what you mentioned earlier about personalization.
Well, personalization is, I think, a knock-on effect of us also doing this well. So what we're hearing from employers is they're saying, you know, I have very distinct populations within my employee base. Some of them need very specific things. An example might be my warehouse team might have very specific musculoskeletal issues that my team in an office might not. So I'd actually like to amend their benefits to really allow for at-home physical therapy and other things that I might not need on the other plan. And so a company that actually inspires me in this way that said, let's think very specifically about what this population needs is a company called Clever Care in California. Are you familiar with them? Mm-hmm. I just think that they nailed it. They said, we're going to build a benefit and a health plan that's 10 times better than what you can get otherwise. And I don't know, to me, that they're incredibly inspirational. And I think there are so many ways to cut up a massive, you know, the U.S. population into more relevant, basically underserved groups of people who have distinct needs that are not really adequately met in the off-the-shelf PPO, one-size-fits-all health plan. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting time right now, too, with there's a lot of pressure from the employer side about bundling and reducing the cost because they keep getting hit by increasing rate. Probably they get tired of it. But I mean, I don't want to miss out on asking you a lot of other questions. My question to you is really like, what are the areas that you learn when you are, you know, doing the 3D printing company and make that transition to do something completely different? What are the skills that you carry through?
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't know that any one thing is so clearly like, I learned this and I used that again. It was a lot of, I'd say, the soft skills that maybe you would learn in another job, but I got my MBA in like the 6 months between graduating and selling the business. It was just so, so intense.
It's a good and cheap way of getting your MBA.
Yeah, pretty much. And I got paid for it. So, that was, yeah. Some of the main things I think I took away had a lot to do with leadership and sort of taking up space. So I had made the mistake leading up to this first business. I read the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People in college. And I thought maybe the way to run team is, you know, everyone has an equal say. We're going to run it like a democracy. I mean, it turns out that has some merits, but it really fails in many regards. And what effectively happened is we had like four CEOs running around and we're all very good friends now. But there was a period of time where I was like, no one could make a decision and we were all sort of wanted to be on the front end. So there are things about leadership and how to structure teams that I learned basically how not to do things very early. It taught me to think in systems. And also it was my first time like fundraising. We actually ended up only taking in grant money. So we're very fortunate at the end that we never actually had to dilute ourselves. But it taught me also how to tell a story. And in many cases, a very complicated story. 3D printing, we're not just 3D printing, like building printers. We are a very specific application within printers that enabled new functionality. And it turns out that was a very complicated story to tell. We were waiting on our patents to get approved. We had to show proof points. And so when it came to healthcare, equally, in many ways, complicated. We're in the health insurance side. We're in the bowels of health insurance. We're infrastructure. It's not the sexiest place to be. And I've gotten some incredible investors and team members around the table who rally around what we're doing because I think I've learned how to tell that story. But there's nothing about, you know, filing a patent or anything of that nature that I necessarily directly apply.
So two questions from that. What you learned from telling the story, especially a complicated and non-sexy, yet it could be really exciting. What are the, do you have like a framework that you can share that help make that story easy to digest and get people excited? Besides your personality and your charm.
So that's a big part of it. You have to be present. You have to look people in the eyes. Like when I'm in a room with people, I've like really learned how to try to command attention. That was something I learned for sure in Spectrum and how to like present in front of a room of people. But storytelling, I've worked with so many founders the years, just as like friends, on how to tell that initial story. And I found there's no one formula that applies to everyone. Every story is pretty unique. And there's a few things that you need to believe. But when a story is well told, and it's a story that in many cases in the earliest stages, there's nothing, there's so little data and proof points. You just have to suspend disbelief and believe in this future world that this entrepreneur is painting. It has to be genuine. I think that that's probably the most important thing. My general framework though, is you have to address why now. So I generally like to start with, maybe this doesn't make the final cut, but what is true in the world today that means there's something missing? What is the state of the world today? So I typically start with the world today as my first piece. And then you have to be talking about a problem. And the more specific the problem, the better. So you want to have numbers, you want to have sizing, be able to explain the quantity, the frequency, and why someone is desperate to do something different. And obviously, the nature of your story changes as you scale, and you stop looking for just pure inspiration. You start looking more towards, here's what the numbers are telling us. And I was very, very lucky when we raised our first round of funding. There's an investor named TJ Mahoney. He was at Accomplice. He's now at Vinyl VC. He was the first person to give me a term sheet. And our first board meeting, I'll never forget, because we're starting to think about growth and all these metrics, and like the pressure's ramping up. We have venture dollars in the bank. Let's go. He says, you know, in a year from now, I'd rather see you have, I forget the number, but like, I'd rather see you have 5 incredibly happy customers that are willing to get on the phone with me and spend half an hour talking about how much they love you, than you have 100 customers who barely know who you are. And it really stuck with me in what matters at different stages and what you're trying to prove. And if there's another founder listening to this, I think one thing that the venture-backed startup media circus ecosystem misses in many cases is they often fail to talk about, they talk about a lot of advice. There's so much great content out there. They often fail to address what stage company is this advice for, because there's a lot of great advice. But if you take that at the wrong stage, you could be totally missing the mark. And so early on, you have to tell an inspiring story, and later on, you need the proof points. You need people to pick up the phone and sit and vouch for you as well.
Mm-hmm. And the second point that you mentioned about what you learn not to do as a leader, what are the three things that the top three things?
I don't know that I have a list of three. I'm kind of thinking through this on the fly right now, but I'm the kind of person, you know, I'm Canadian, and I love building teams where we can disagree. We can have a bit of a sparring culture, but when you're sparring, you put your gloves down at the end, you give each other a hug. And it's like, we put our best ideas out. We were not shy about talking through things and being misunderstood. But it comes from a place of seeking the best outcome and that like collective trust for we are going to disagree and it's in the best interest. It's in our collective best interest to get to that point. I think that the thing that I believe for a while, it made me uncomfortable to have those moments of like non-consensus. And this is purely my like personality type. Is a big growth period for me came with being comfortable, being in disagreement for a known period of time and building agreement that we will disagree in a sense. And I think the first time around, I probably didn't have that as much.
And do you have like a secret or the trick on now that you be more comfortable with being to disagree?
I think it's doing it a few times, right? And seeing that, you know, people don't necessarily take things personally and you'll talk through it. And at the end of the day, you're going to build something more important. And, you know, I think this job and my role is just so different than what it was when I started. And I'm still learning every day what Bloom needs from me at different chapters of our journey.
Which brings me to my two last questions. What is the best advice that you receive?
I think I'll go back to what TJ told me. I've received such good advice over the years. But TJ's advice that I'd rather see you have 5 customers that love you than, you know, 100 who barely know who you are, also kind of taught me, embedded in that, is knowing when to run at a problem and when to spend the 80, 100 hours a week working and when to sort of make sure that you're being patient and you're getting ready for the next piece. I really see so many founders that also kind of go into this sort of hustle mentality, like I need to work 100 hours a week every single week. The reality is building a company is a marathon. It takes years and years and years. And in many cases, there are some times when, you know, you're doing everything you can and you can't go faster. In those cases, the best thing you can do as a founder or as a leader is sometimes get some fresh air, you know, read a book, think about something else, and you'll come back to the problem with a fresh perspective and energy to really tackle it.
Okay. And what is the worst advice that you got?
I've gotten a lot of bad advice as well. I think the worst advice, there's a lot of advice that you hear and people who don't know your business or your stage or the nuances, and you'll hear a soundbite. It might not just be on a podcast or a piece of media, but it may be someone like a family friend who's also in business that tells you something about something and you take that. It works for them. It might not work for you. And I think taking advice on the surface level, just because it seems to be coming from like a reputable source and not really understand the context behind why that advice maybe worked, has probably cost me a lot of hours.
I wonder sometimes, especially when, you know, somebody who is very reputable, they try to help and then they don't have the time to understand where you are. Because everybody always say, oh, you know, sure, sell it at a lot more money, then you make more money. But, you know,
yeah,
it doesn't always go so well when you tried it.
I mean, those people certainly exist. And I've been so lucky to have those people in my life and in many stages of my career that, I mean, they take the time to learn, and you'll see that these are folks that listen for a long time before they speak. And then everything they give you is sort of caveated with, this is what I think. Or you know, these are also the people that like consistently fact check themselves. So absolutely surround yourself with those people. I think just the bad advice generally comes in the form of, might not even be someone you know, it might just be something you hear in a podcast or in like a blog or something, and it doesn't necessarily apply to you. but you try to make it work. And if it's not for your situation, like the mandate, for example, for most startups is grow. And that's absolutely true. But there are moments where you have something to learn and you should take a moment to learn that thing before you go all in on maybe a product or a decision that may be irreversible for 12 to 18 months.
Almost like you're just saying, it's knowing when to run and when to slow down.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's mental on me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your insight. I can talk a lot more on your business side, because I think there's a lot of exciting things going on right now in that side of the world. Wish you all the best at what you're doing at Flume.
Thank you, Christine. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.